Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm Aaron.
And Aaron is filling in for John, who still can't be with us for the foreseeable future. So I appreciate you subbing in, dude. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Hey, you know what? Any day you're not covered in somebody else's skin is a pretty good day, right?
It's a true story.
For those of you who've listened to some of Aaron's previous episodes, you'll understand why that's so funny. And if you haven't, you should immediately pause this episode and go back and listen to that. Well, I'm glad everything's been good. I know you and your family came through the Rona just like me and my family did.
Yeah.
You've had some lingering a little longer than I even had. So
still got it.
Still got it.
Still waiting for my smell and taste to get normal.
Yeah. Right. But one of the reasons I decided, to ask Aaron to come back, well, besides the fact that I've known him for years and I like the guy, despite his time as a firefighter, Aaron and I tested for some sheriff's departments together, and we've known each other since high school, but Aaron's also a nurse, and our guest Linz, or do you prefer Linz or Lindsay?
Either one. If I hear Lindsay, it's usually because like I'm in trouble. So usually I just go by Linz.
Okay, so Linz it is then. Because as far as we're concerned, you're not in any trouble yet.
Not yet.
Right. No, so Linz contacted us, and she's a nurse. And as far as I'm concerned, Aaron and I have talked about this. Nursing is one of those professions that deals with a lot of the same issues that firefighters, police officers, veterans, but also, I mean, people forget nursing, dispatch, EMTs. You know, we've had the medics on, and every medic, you know, especially James with his lobster claw and other stories, you know, the awful stuff you see, it can accumulate. And so Linz reached out to us to talk about some of the stuff that she's experienced as a nurse. And so Linz, why don't you tell us how you got into nursing, how long you've been in nursing, what kind of your specialty is, and all that kind of stuff. And we'll go from there.
Yeah. So in 1999, I was working for a major health system here in Oregon, and they started a new pilot program offering scholarships for full-time employment. And so I applied for one of the scholarships. I was already working for the health system as a radiology tech assistant. So I was pretty familiar with medicine and knew that that was kind of what I wanted to do, or felt like that was what I wanted to do. So I applied for one of the scholarships, and it was for the registered nursing program through the community college. And, you know, just had to do an essay, you know, a little bit about your background, why it is you wanted to be in the medical field. And I ended up getting one of the two scholarships for that year, that was that first year that it was offered. And so I went to school, and the trade-off was 4 years of full-time employment. So after that was kind of the payback for the schooling. So they, you know, they invest in you, and then you invest in them as a means of giving back. And so that was what I did. I, at the time, I was married, and I had a, when I was done with school, I had a 2-year-old little boy who's 19 now. But I chose to stay at the hospital and, invest in neurovascular recovery. So brains and spines, you know, acute care, end of life care, a lot of end of life care. expected and unexpected, you know, traumatic brain injuries, everything from, you know, car accidents to, you know, late stage Alzheimer's. So,
so it could be an organic cause of the brain and spine problem, or it could be a traumatic cause, and you were dealing with all of it.
Yeah, exactly. And running the gamut. So I always just say brains and spines is just the easiest way to describe it. So
what was,
you know,
the majority of surgery. What was the majority of the
orthopedic
cases
you've done? Or spinal orthopedic surgeries, neurosurgeries, laminectomies, that was pretty common, but I think my calling at the time was more the dementia and end of life care. And I don't know why that was, but that just seemed to be the place that I gravitated most to on the unit. So, I stayed with the health system for 8 years. And part of my story is that particular type of nursing is really physically demanding, but, you know, not just emotionally and mentally demanding, but physically demanding, because most of these patients can't physically, you know, they're all shaped of vegetable, right? Yeah, exactly. They're either heavily sedated because they're at the end of their life, or, you know, they're post-op. So they're, you know, they need help getting up and, you know, up out of bed to the bathroom, shower, that sort of thing.
So a lot of them are like vegetative state.
Yeah, exactly.
And if they're not, I would imagine with the spine stuff, you're going to have partial paralysis, full paralysis, paraplegic, quadriplegic, all those kinds of things too. And, by definition, they're not able to move their own weight.
And a lot of these people are probably new to it. Not all of them, obviously. So then they don't know how to use their own weight yet.
Yeah,
so
they don't know how to do the transfer. They don't know how to get themselves in and out of a bed or in and out of a chair.
And you add to that, it's that new, I would imagine they're still emotionally adjusting as well. So they're not going to be like necessarily the cheeriest of people.
So there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, well, and then you think about like for the dementia patients, they're combative, you know, they're confused and combative, you know, they get little sundowners and all of a sudden, you know, you're their, you know, their evil stepmom that they had, you know, 40 years ago and they're coming at you. So, you know, and this, you know, was 20 years ago. So there, you know, a lot of the laws have changed about restraints and how those things can be used. And, you know, at that time we were still able to somewhat restrain folks, but you know, if they weren't, you were ducking and missing punches and kicks and that sort of stuff. So that leads me to, you know, the physical demanding part, and I'm 5'2", so I'm a little smaller on the spectrum, but you know, having to move somebody that's 300 pounds and can't help themselves, you know, puts a lot of physical strain on the body. And, you know, that's where my story begins and why I reached out to you guys when you were, when you guys first started your podcast, is because I got injured on the job. And, you know, I didn't think it was that big of a deal. But I got hurt and, I went and saw, you know, my primary care doctor, and the primary care doctor was like, well, you know, we'll just give you some muscle relaxers and, some Vicodin and see if that helps.
This must have been a work comp doctor.
Yeah.
Muscle relaxers and painkillers is the hallmark of any. It's ibuprofen if you're in the military, and it's muscle relaxers and Vicodin if it's a work comp claim.
And it's Toradol if you're in the ER.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I got that first prescription of Vicodin, and I went home. And I took it, and it was like a light switch flipped in my head. It was the most amazing thing that I had ever experienced in my life. And I say that because, you know, the job that I was doing was emotionally and mentally exhausting and demanding, not just physically. And so what the narcotics did was it quieted that noise between my ears. Mm-hmm. And it didn't make it go away fully, but it made it so quiet that it made me want more.
Right. It did to your emotions and your thoughts what it also does to your pain, which is it doesn't get rid of it, but it takes it to a level where you're like, oh, I can
turns it off.
I can handle this.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, the best part is, you know, we all know that people's, you know, human brain chemistry is different for everybody. It's why not everybody gets hooked on alcohol, why not everybody gets hooked on heroin. It, you know, everybody's kind of got their flavors because we're all different in that capacity. You know, for me, what worked was the opiates. And, you know, it didn't do for me what I have seen it do for other people. It didn't made me, it didn't make me slow down. It made me invincible. It made me super mom and super wife to the point where I could go and work and I could come home and mow the lawn and wash the cars and get all the laundry done and make dinner and do it again the next day. Right. You know, and I did that for quite a few years. I did that for about 4 or 5 years. And I,
were you still suffering from the injury as well? Or
oh,
was
it, yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. And you know, and how that worked was, you know, in order to keep the supply going, the injury had to stay in place. You know, I had to, you know, the injury stayed in place. It never got better. I did the physical therapy. I wore a back brace. You know, I cut back on my work hours. I did the work comp thing. But because the injury never got better, it was easier and it was easier to access the narcotics, you know, and when I would run, when I'd run out with one doctor, because one doctor would be like, well, you're not getting better. You know, I'm not going to treat you anymore. I'd find another doctor, and in recovery, we call that doctor shopping. You know, and if I couldn't get a doctor, then I'd go to an urgent care. If I couldn't get somebody, or if I, you know, burned through an urgent care, I'd go to an ER. And, you know, part of my story is that eventually I ran through everything and everybody in my area, and I had no place else to go but to the streets. And I, because of my addiction and where I was using, because as you know, the years went by, my tolerance increased. So I needed more narcotics to keep that noise quiet and to keep the pain level down. You know, what we know about narcotics is that it actually causes rebound pain when you stop taking it initially. Right. So when you stop taking the narcotics, your pain comes back tenfold. And so your brain is telling you, I need more narcotics. I need more to make this feel better.
I'm worse. Oh my God, I'm worse. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so simple. Your body, if people don't know this, your body does it with just about everything. Nasal spray. You use nasal spray enough that when you stop using it, your nose is going to be runnier and stuffier than before you started using the nasal spray.
Yeah.
Same. Yeah. Your body just does that when it rebounds off of, you know, some sort of.
So it was like every time, you know, I'd start to run out, you know, I would feel the pain all over again, have to go find more. So, you know, I ended up finding a supplier, and for the sake of your platform, I'll leave, you know, names, locations, and that sort of thing out of this conversation.
Sure. I'm sure he would appreciate that.
I don't know.
Where was he? Where can we look? Where,
what was that corner again?
What was that corner?
Fargo. No. So,
go see
so
Little Puppet on Crenshaw and 3rd.
The alley behind the CVS.
That's right.
Yeah.
Third trash can.
You.
Yeah. Okay. So moving on from there, the point of that was that, you know, I was still able to find it, but unfortunately I, you know, got to that place where I had to now access it illegally. And
now I've got a question. How, because there's illegal and then there's illegal, right? Yeah. So, you know, some people can think of like meeting up with a soccer mom who's got a connection and she's got an unlimited supply of Vicodin as, you know, oh, you know, I'm just getting my prescription outside the pharmacy. Well, no, soccer mom's still a drug dealer, but how illegal are we talking about? Are we talking like you're meeting with shady characters in a back alley, or are we talking about soccer Both. Moms? At, okay.
Both.
So Both. Whatever, any port in a storm at that point.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, and to be real, I was that soccer mom, except for me, it was Little League. You know, my oldest, as he, you know, was growing, you know, was doing sports, and I was fucking driving your kids to Little League, you know, popping pills like you wouldn't believe. And, you know, there's addiction doesn't discriminate. There is no human on this planet that it can't touch in some way, shape, or form. You know, we tend to think of the homeless person on the street that's living in the tent, that's pissing in the alley, you know, and that's your standard everyday junkie. But right now in 2021, it's not. You know, your standard everyday junkie is living in the suburbs, driving your kids to soccer practice, you know, and that's the part that I try to bring to the table when I talk to people about addiction and recovery, because it's got a new face and there's still so much stigma around addiction and recovery that people aren't talking about it and they're not bringing it out into the open. You know, and that's the tragedy. That's where we're losing people. That's where we're not getting the help out that is needed. You know, and I've heard so many of your guys' stories, you know, on your podcast, you know, about the PTSD and the trauma and the shit that these folks are coming out of. And I can't imagine that somebody's not struggling, that somebody's not, you know, got a hold of whatever chemical it is, alcohol, pills, you know, you name it, whatever it is, and that they're not helping make that noise quiet.
We've had people on the show that have admitted, you know, when they've run into problems, whether it's, you know, getting injured on the job or whether it's emotional injuries, you know, been addicted to Vicodin, been addicted to opiates, been addicted to alcohol. And they've talked about it on the show. But, you know, what's crazy is as many people as have talked, been willing to talk about it on the show, I've talked to way more firefighters, cops, you know, police officers, veterans, all these people that, they'll tell you, oh yeah, you know, there was a while I was drinking too much, or there was a while where I was this. They know it. We know we did it. Yeah. We just try to suffer our way through it till we, you know, get better and
move on. Well, who do you want to talk to? I mean, I didn't want to talk to anybody that I was working with about this stuff, but I'll be damn certain that they knew what was going on. They knew something was not right. I mean, I was a highly functioning addict for a number of years. And I know that's kind of a bit of a dichotomy or irony, but, you know, I was really able to maintain, you know, normal life for a long time, but eventually it stops. Eventually there's consequences that started to catch up with me. And that happened, you know, initially it started with work. You know, I started, you know, not showing up to work, calling in sick. And it was because I would end up in withdrawals from running out of the pills. I would be in a place where I couldn't physically get out of bed and get to work. And so, you know, I'd be calling in sick, you know, trying to hustle and you know, find what I could to get better, get well.
Right.
And, you know, and so work was the first place that really started to notice it, but nobody said anything. Not one person would come to me and ask, what's going on? Do you need help?
They probably talked plenty of shit about you behind your back,
though. Oh, fuck yeah, they did. Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sure. And then because I chose to actually leave, I left the health system that I was with because I at that point, I'd already been there 8 years. So I'd fulfilled my duty to giving back, you know, my education to them. And so I thought, okay, well, you know, maybe if I get another job, maybe if I work somewhere else, I can, you know, this'll get better. And, you know, and at home, things weren't great. You know, things were starting to slip at home. You know, I was still married, but it was rocky. You know, he didn't really know what was going on. I was able to hide it from him, up until the end. And, you know, and I tried my best to hide it from my kid, but at the end of the day, I really didn't, you know, he, because he was at home with me most of the time when we were at home and I wasn't working at school, he saw me, he saw me, you know, what we call dope sick, you know, strung out, laying on the bathroom floor and, you know, in withdrawals, you know, I'd say, oh, mom's got the stomach flu, but you know, how many times in a week or in a month can we get the stomach flu? So, right. You know, my kid saw all this stuff. And even though at the time he wasn't old enough for it to register, you know, I talk about it with him now and he's like, yeah, I know what was going on, you know, and the worst part was, you know, there was a time we were driving in the car And, you know, and I was taking pills, I mean, all day long. I don't want to give you the numbers, but it's amazing what the human body is able to build a tolerance up to. But I, you know, reached into my purse. I always had a stash, you know, it was in my coin section of my wallet. That's where I kept my pill stash when I go anywhere, because I didn't like the rattle of the pills in the purse. I didn't want people to know that I was using. So I kept the stash, and I reached over and grabbed some out of my purse, out of my wallet, and went to put it in my mouth. And my kid from the back seat says, "What are you doing?" And it wasn't like he hadn't seen that action before. He'd seen that action probably hundreds of times at that point. But for some reason, you know, he said, "What are you doing? What are you putting in your mouth?" And looking back on that, it's, you know, it's like, maybe it's because he really did see the change at that time. Like, he could see me coming down. And then when mom had put, you know, the pills in, he could see me coming back up.
How old was he at the time?
At that time, he was 6.
So he's becoming more aware. Yeah. He's becoming more aware, and he's starting to put two and two together, and, you know, maybe
whatever
never registered.
It is that's in my purse, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is, you know, making me not mom, you know, right. That's kind of what he's putting together. And so that always really stuck with me, that he had the wherewithal to say that to me, you know, and I don't remember what my response to him was. I honestly don't. Probably, you know, ibuprofen or Tylenol, you know, or whatever.
Sure. Tic-tacs. Prescription Tic-tacs.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, so that kids know, kids are not dumb. You know, I try to think that I could hide, you know, that stuff from him, and I couldn't, you know, and so that's why it's been really important for him. And especially early on, when I got clean and sober, that he be a part of that process with me. I have 3 sons. I have a 19-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 4-year-old. And, you know, the 14-year-old and the 4-year-old have never seen me high or drunk. That to me is amazing. That's a gift, because those 2 boys don't ever have to live with that version of mom that my oldest did. But I left the major health system that I was at, and, you know, moved to another health system. Thought, okay, and for that particular job, I was in post-op, pre-op, post-op for surgery, day surgeries, just small hospital. And I lasted there about a year and a half before I, you know, just kind of was like, all right, I'm done. This isn't going to work. Like, I just was so sick at that point, right, that, you know, I wasn't functioning. And so I, you know, at that point, I was unhirable, more or less. And
is it a small enough community that you had a reputation, and that's why you were unhirable? No. Or were you just such a mess?
Just a mess.
No, you, yeah. Nobody. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Just a hot mess. Just, you know, not, you know. Yeah. So, you know, I couldn't have passed a piss test anyway at that point. So, right. It, you know, if I'd have gone and had to do a UA, I'd have been dirty for a few things, because at that point it moved beyond the pills. You know, pills are expensive, and they still are to this day. I got to a place where I ended up smoking heroin because it was cheaper. I never needled it because I was afraid of the risks that were involved being in healthcare.
That also seems like, for a lot of people, is the bridge too far, right? That's like, I'm okay because I'm still not using needles, right? I'm smoking it.
Well, and I could justify it because it was prescribed.
Right.
You know, in my head, I'm like, oh, a doctor says I need this, so I really do need this. So for years, I justified using because the doctor was prescribing it. Now, it may not have been my doctor, you know, going to an ER, going to an urgent care. This doctor's never met me before. And this was, you know, this was at the beginning of, you know, what we call the opioid crisis. So, you know, right. Big Pharma was peddling oxycodone, Oxycontin, and, you know, saying, oh, it's not addictive. There's no problem.
No, oxys
with it.
Are fine. It's fine. What are you talking about?
And giving kickbacks to providers that were prescribing it. Right. So, you know, peddle more, give more out. So, so it certainly didn't help, you know, that was the drug that worked for me for a long time, that it was also being peddled by, you know, Big Pharma to the providers. They were willingly giving it.
Yeah. Imagine a crack epidemic, but you could actually go to a doctor to get crack.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. You'd be surprised.
Right.
Yeah. So the very last job that I had in the nursing field was working. So the very last place that I was able to get hired, and at this point, I, you know, my husband and I had divorced. You know, we had 50-50 custody of our son, and I went and applied at a nursing home. And I, you know,
yeah, they have
I
got all the good drugs.
Yeah. Well, and this is, you know, and again, you know, I guess a somewhat moral and ethic, you know, nurse is that I'd never copped meds from the patients. Somewhere in my brain, I couldn't do that.
Right.
And even on my worst day when I was, you know, just fucking miserable, dope sick, needing something, handing those pills over to the patients was more important than, you know, than me sealing them. And again, you know, I don't know why. I don't know why my brain said, you know, don't do that, but I never did. And that's hard to believe because that's really common.
It is really common.
And especially I think that's
with the needles, was your bridge too far. There were mental lines you had probably because I think everybody draws these mental lines in their head. And some people are the kind of people where they'll never cross those mental lines they draw in their head. Yeah. They'll just walk right up to them and stare over the edge.
Well, it's an image they've held in their head for years and years, and now they're becoming that person. They don't want to overstep that.
Right. As long as I'm not that guy, right? Yeah. As long as I can be as fucked up as I want, as long as I'm not the guy that I see as too fucked up.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So somewhere in there, my brain just said, you know, don't. And so I lasted at the nursing, it was a skilled nursing facility. I lasted there for about 4 months. And I just, at that point, my using was so out of control that, I was not functioning. So I walked out in the middle of a shift. I was night charge nurse at that time because I couldn't work days, and even they knew, I mean, I didn't pass the UA, but they still hired me because they were so short staffed and I was willing to take the job for so little money. That they, you know, they more or less hired me on the spot, and in my brain and in my head, I'm like, why the fuck did they hire me in the first place? Like, they saw me coming, like,
because it's a shitty job and it's hard to get skilled people to do it.
Exactly. And I had references because I was good at my job. You know, when I was working neurovascular, that was my calling. I loved what I did at the time. And it, you know, I was good. You know, I don't take a lot of pride, and you know, and I try to stay humble about the life that I have today, but I was a good nurse. I did a good job. And so I had strong references that came with me. So I'm sure that's probably the only reason that I got hired, because I didn't pass the UA. It was dirty for opiates. But they never asked me about it. So
they probably figured, well, she has a prescription like everybody else.
Yeah, maybe. I never asked.
Now, how much your peak, how much were you using?
60 Percocet a day and 20 Xanax.
I'm sorry. What now?
60.
60.
Yeah. 60 and, Percocet in a 24-hour
day. And 20 Xanax.
Yeah. Take the Xanax to come down so you can sleep. Percocet to keep you going. Yeah. It is incredible what the tolerance that the human body can build up. And again, I'm 5'2". I'm small. That's a lot of pills.
Like that's a number, like that's a number I was not prepared for.
I was thinking like
20, 25.
No. Right. Yeah. Oh God, no. That'd be in 2 hours. That's easy. You know? No, no. So yeah.
And I'm going to tell you right now, the thing that scares me more than that is the amount of Tylenol that you just hammered yourself with.
The acetaminophen in my gut and my liver. Absolutely. So at the end, and this is, you know, and don't think that there weren't physical consequences of using, you know, that quantity of opiates. There were. I destroyed my gut. You know, my kidneys began to shut down the very last few days before I got into rehab. You know, I wasn't peeing at that point, literally self-catheterizing because I could not urinate. Like, my kidneys were just fucking toast. So there were physical consequences as well as, you know, emotional, mental, spiritual consequences of my using. So, you know, that last night that I was working, I had 60 patients in the facility. I had 4 CNAs, 2 for each unit. And I walked out in the middle of my shift. and I never went back. Turns out the state board's not a big fan of that.
That's where they draw the line. Walking out in the middle of your shift.
You can keep using the quantity of drugs that you are while you're working. You're not a risk to the patients or other staff. But when you leave the place, that's where we're like, So I do not have my nursing license at this point, but so after I walked out on the job and at that point being so physically ill just from the amount of opiates I was ingesting, because remember I was smoking heroin at that time because the pills ran out and the pills were expensive. So, you know, it was a combination of that perfect storm for me. I knew I needed help. Like I was at that place where I was like, okay, my kidneys are shutting down. I'm not urinating. You know, I walked out on my job. I know this is not going to, like, I know I'm fired. Like, I know I can't go back to this job.
Yeah. Oh, I'm 100% fired.
You know, I burned my marriage and my family to the ground. You know, there was nothing left. And so I knew I needed help and I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to do. You know, there was no training for, you know, addiction and recovery in nursing school. I do believe now, for at least for medical, for your doctorate, they are incorporating some sort of an addiction class or semester or something. I've heard rumor about it. I'm not familiar with it, which is amazing, because how do we help somebody if we don't know what's wrong with them?
Right.
You know, how are we supposed to treat somebody or diagnose or get them resources if we, you know, as the medical professionals, don't know what's wrong with them or how to treat it? So,
compared to a lot of things like cancer research and stuff, like addiction medicine's in its infancy, and it doesn't get anywhere near the amount of money thrown at it that something, that, you know.
I don't know that it's in its infancy. I think just the research behind it's been hush hush.
Really?
Like in my ER,
there's a lot of research that we don't know about.
In my ER, we just received a bunch of like literature training, and you know, they finally come out and said, stop trying to send your patients to rehab, because that's where they get most of their stuff from, and that's where they get addicted. That's, you know, like these rehab places are filled with a bunch of people who are just coming off either off the street or trying to get through their addiction. And a lot of them still have all their stuff. And so a lot of them are getting re-addicted. And so what they're trying to do is like combine rehab with medication processes that help bring them down chemically wise and then address the underlying issue, which is, you know, depression or PTSD,
that noise between the ears.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It comes from. Yeah. Or I think that's where, you know, the physical injury manifests. So you treat the physical injury, but now if you haven't treated that noise between the ears, whatever it is, you know, whether it's just, I had low self-esteem as a kid and I never felt great about myself, or, you know, trauma, PTSD, it's noise. And if whatever it is that you've put into your body has quieted that noise, that's the addiction. That's where it is. That's what needs to be treated.
I think it just shows like that people have been working on it, talking about it, because the information I had is, you know, you look at it and you go, yeah, we've been saying this for forever. You know, now that they're just publishing it and putting it out at, you know.
But that's what I mean by in its infancy. We're finally starting to deal with it as a real,
sure.
And you go back to people. I took a DUI class from the guy who actually did Betty Ford's intervention. It was a week long DUI school, great school. And one of the days was a Navy doctor who had been had left the Navy as an admiral and been a surgeon and all this other crap. But he was the doctor who did Betty Ford's intervention. And that's where he was an expert on alcohol abuse and actually addiction. And one of the things that he said was that he started his path down researching addiction in the Vietnam War, but it was his own little pet project, because what would happen is he'd be on this ship. The ship would pull into a port. There'd be all these fine, upstanding young men who served honorably on the ship. For the last couple of months, they'd pull into a port. they'd all get off the ship, and within 8 hours, a third of those fine, upstanding young men were being poured back onto the ship or brought back in handcuffs, or were actually taken into custody, you know, in on shore leave, because they'd gotten so rip roaring drunk and they were just sick and all these. And he goes, what makes this happen? Yeah. What makes a normal, upstanding young sailor do this? And he started really looking into it. And that's only the Vietnam War. And that's one guy. So, you know, now that we're starting, I mean, shoot, when you talk about AIDS, the amount of money thrown at the AIDS epidemic was enormous. And it was because it had celebrity behind it. It was sexy. Yeah. It was cool. But addiction is just a dark, dirty secret. There's nothing
it's
sexy about
stigmatized.
It.
It's still so stigmatized, and people don't want to talk about it. People don't want to come out and say, you know, I'm an addict, you know, or I'm an alcoholic, you know, because it will ruin your reputation. And depending on where you are, you might not be able to work even in recovery, you know? So when I walked on the job and, you know, and I got home and I was like, you know, I can't do this. Like, I know that, you know, my kidneys are shut down. My heart's next. Like, this is not good. And I didn't want to die. I mean, physically, yes, I wanted to die, but mentally I didn't want to die. I still had my kid who was 7 at the time. And I just thought, God, you know, I don't want to leave this legacy for him. That is, you know, my mom was a junkie and couldn't get her shit together.
Right.
So I literally went online to my ginormous laptop at the time, which, you know, which right. was big Dell, and I Googled withdrawals, and because I didn't even know to Google or look up, you know, recovery. So I you know, I Googled withdrawals, and you know, I found a couple of different rehabs that popped up, you know, nationally. I didn't have health insurance at the time because that wasn't, I hadn't been on
because
the
you
job
walked
long
out of
enough.
Your job. Right.
Well, and I hadn't even been there long enough. You know, I think you had to be there like 90 days, and I literally was only there like 65, 66 days. Like I wasn't there that long. So wow. I never got my benefits. So I didn't have insurance. I had a little bit of savings. But it hadn't come through yet, cause it was the equity being right. split between my ex and I from the selling of the house. So, you know, it was still in escrow. And so I knew I had money coming, but I didn't have money at the time. And so
it's probably good that you didn't get that sooner.
Oh God. Yeah. I would have blown through it and probably not be here.
Right.
You know, I'd have, you know, partied and OD'd. So, you know, so I found a treatment facility that was, you know, local, semi-local, about 100 miles away, and, you know, got myself checked in. And, you know, they knew that, you know, part of it was I had to disclose that I'd been in the nursing field, that I was licensed, that I'd walked out on my job. And the treatment facility ran interference for me. They contacted the state board, let them know that I was checking into treatment, that I was going into rehab for, you know, opiate and alcoholism. You know, at that point I was drinking to cope with withdrawals. So, you know, alcohol is a part of my story too. But the treatment facility ran interference with the state board. I had to wait for my 30 days. I did inpatient 30-day inpatient program to detox and to be medically stabilized. Once I got out of treatment, I met with the state board. I met with the investigator, sat down and just explained what happened. And they gave me two options. One was to do at the time, my clean and sober date is September 3rd, 2009. So at that time in 2009, it was called the Blue Flag Program. And it was a 5-year probationary period where you, for 5 years, you're under the state board's wing. And I mean like wings. And you get random UAs, you go to 12-step meetings, and you do their classes. They offered a class like once a week for like 6 months. And
it's like county probation.
Yeah. And that way you could keep your license. But because opiates were my drug of choice, they removed that option for me to be able to administer any medication to patients. That you're basically like a glorified high paid CNA.
And you're like, wait, that's the one thing I didn't do.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, wait, but I never caught meds from patients. Like, I'm good with this, you know?
Right, right.
But it, you know, it was the principle. So
you buy the ticket, you take the ride. If that's the deal they want to offer, that's the deal they're going to offer, and take it or leave it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, and option two was to turn over my license and to be done. And I just said, you know what? If I needed to get loaded every day to go to work and do my job, this probably isn't the career for me. Yes, I loved what I did and I was good at it, but it's just not the job for me. And so I turned over my license to the state board and haven't done direct patient care since then. I am still in the medical field, just in a different capacity. Lucky for me, I got my second COVID shot. Sorry, you guys got it.
I'm happy to have it.
I got my second dose 4 days before I got my real dose. Oh,
God. So, yeah, that's all right. What scares me. So I opted to give my license back. And it's never been a decision that I've regretted other than monetarily, because you make way better money, you know.
Well, I'm glad you don't regret it. I thought it was interesting when you said that, you know, if I had to get, you know, doped up to go to work every day, then it probably wasn't the job for me. But to me, it sounds like that's the dope, not your actual, my initial thought was that's the dope, not your actual thought. So, but hearing you say you don't regret it now, like I'm happy to hear that, because that's a huge choice.
Well, and I think
it's, I mean, we work hard to get our licenses. That's not an easy path. And state boards is, it's, you know, it's written to a doctor or a lawyer or anyone else who's in their license. That's a big deal. So,
but at the same time, Aaron, I think you can probably identify, because when you decided to be a nurse, you voluntarily walked away from firefighting, and that's a hard career to get into. That's a hard, you know, that's a hard thing to walk away from for a lot of people, because it's their lifelong goal is to be a firefighter, and you decided nursing was better for you than firefighting. So
kind of, yes, except for that the city that I worked for, this doctor put that I had a certain percentage of disability that no other fire department wanted to bring on. So, but you know, I could have fought that. And
yes,
I chose.
That's
not
what
to.
I'm saying. It's the same thing with me. You know, when I was retired, I was put out to pasture. My department had the option to keep me, but they decided not to, and they decided not to extend any of that. And I decided that instead of pursuing, you know, a career in another department with all that baggage, I would just take my life in a new direction. Sometimes you have to play the cards you're dealt.
Which I kind of like the direction it went. brought you closer to home. And
yeah, exactly.
Got some cool.
A little shirts. Safer. A little safer. Well, cool, maybe not.
Yeah, it's been, you know, I can understand what you're saying, because I look back, and when I was retired out, I didn't want to retire. It wasn't my choice. It wasn't what I wanted to do with my life. It's not even where I saw my life going. But when you sometimes you look at where your career is taking you, and you look at where your family is taking you, and if it's two different directions, you're going to have to make a choice.
Yeah.
And, And that's, you know, that's the bottom line. That's the God's honest truth. Yes. I know so many cops and firefighters that have chosen career, you know, and in many cases, as scary as this is, they didn't realize they were doing it. They didn't realize they were making that choice. They didn't even see it happening until one day they woke up and they had lost everything, and all they had was the job.
I know a Medal of Valor, former LAPD guy who, you know, now lays turf for like huge stadiums and stuff, and it's his family's company. He's like 10 times more happier and safer and making 10 times more money, and he doesn't have to deal with the politics of it all. But I mean, that says a lot. I mean, that guy was a incredible police officer. So,
well, what's interesting too is Linz, your description of how you felt about not wanting to go to anybody or not feeling like you could go to anybody is similar to what a lot of cops and firefighters, you know, I knew a couple of people, including myself, if I went to a therapist or a shrink, you know, and this happened to a young man that's been on this podcast, you know, he said he was having difficulties, and instead of, you know, okay, rally around him and, you know, okay, let's help you get through this because we realize that this could happen to any one of us and it's happening to you. So let's help you. It was, you're fucked up. Give us your badge and your gun. Go sit on your ass at home and be ashamed of yourself for letting this happen to you and come back when you get your head straight.
Yeah.
And then if you do get back, you got this, you know, tail on you that you're unstable. You're no, you know, I mean, what's the Lethal Weapon line? Either I'm faking to draw a pension and nobody wants to work with me, or I'm really psychotic and nobody wants to work with me. Either way, I'm fucked and nobody wants to work with me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and, you know, because we have moved forward, you know, to a degree with addiction and recovery, you know, there's a lot more resources available now in 2021 than there was in 2009.
For
you know, there's so many resources and I can, you know, send you guys just some of the bigger ones if you want for, you know, in case anybody reaches out. But, you know, what's really interesting to me is, you know, like I said, the stigma that comes with it and putting that new face to recovery, not just to addiction, because, you know, I know what my life looked like when I was drinking and using, but my life today is still focused on recovery. You know, I do 12-step, you know, meetings today, still today. You know, I try to help others. I try not to hide the fact that I'm in recovery because somebody might actually, you know, need help. And if I can help one person, you know, if my experience can help one person, then maybe it was worth, you know, burning my life to the ground. You know, I have to think that there was a reason for why I went through all of this. You know, God didn't put me on the earth just to go through all of this and not do anything with it. You know, and I'm not the poster child for recovery or got anything like that. I mean, I'm more like a warm pile than a hot mess these days, you know? So let me just clarify that, you know, life's all over the place and I still have to cope. And that noise between my ears, it still gets loud on days, but you know,
I've had that noise between my ears for years.
Yep. God, and you know, and having to find new coping skills for that don't
sleep
involve
sleep is not
chemicals.
My friend.
No.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, and God, I mean, even now, 11 years later, you know, not having those chemicals in my brain, how do I turn that noise down enough to sleep at night? How do I turn that noise down enough to work? Because I do work. I have a full-time job. I am married today. I'm, you know, I have an amazing husband. Like I said, I have three boys. My 14-year-old is my stepson. I have a 4-year-old. Now I have a really incredible life that I have rebuilt in recovery. You know, so I don't hide. You know, Tom, you've seen on my, you know, how we met was through social media. Mm-hmm. I stepped away from social media a few months ago. It made the noise loud. So I just needed to stop. So, you know, I stopped. But I, you know, show, you know, when I get a milestone, you know, or, oh, I did, you know, this, and it's because of recovery that I, you know, I did this, you know, because I want to help other people. You know, that's why I got into the nursing field, was to help others, is because I'm a caregiver. I'm an innate caregiver. And it's, you know, even though I'm not in the nursing field now, I'm still in the medical field. Like I still gravitated towards that, helping other people, you know, life. And
what are you doing now?
I work for the same major health system that I did when I was working neurovascular,
that a girl.
But they have their own, they have their own insurance. And so I am a claims processor. And, you know, it seems really, you know, in my brain, my ego goes, oh, you were in the nursing field and now you're a claims processor. Like, what a big fucking step down. But, you know, what I get to do every day when I process claims is use that part of my brain that did all of the stuff that was required for my nursing degree and in the nursing field. So when I see a claim come through, you know, that a provider's messed up or whatever, I can see the problem and the solution because I've done it. You know, it's like, okay, when the procedure came through and it, you know, it was a spiral fracture, it's like, oh, I know what they need to get this claim processed. So I still get to use that part of my brain that, you know, actually was tangible and was in you know, in real life. But I don't have to worry about anybody dying on me today. And I think that's maybe that's why it wasn't my calling. You know, is because that's the first 100%. Thing I say is nobody dies on me. You know, right. If they do, it's a claim that's already, you know, the patient's already passed away and I'm just processing the claim and I don't have to be there to see it.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe that's it at the end of the day.
Yeah. I had the same ego issues when I came off the job. And I came off the job and I thought that part of my life is gone. It's over. I can just move on. I don't, you know, I'll just leave it as a chapter and close the book and I don't have to go back to it. But it kept coming back that, you know, that part of my life gave me purpose. That part of my life gave me meaning. That part of my life made me a contributor. It meant something, you know, it was an internal thing. It was that, like we talk about being in the military and being a firefighter and being a nurse and being a police officer. It's a calling, right? You don't get into this field for shits and giggles and to stick. Well, yeah. Most people don't get into this field to just stick their holes in other people's holes. You know, it's just, that's one of the things we do as a part of the job, but it's not why we do it. We do it to help people. And I had to come to terms with the fact that I still wanted to help and I still wanted to be involved. And, you know, Aaron and I have talked about it and you know, that's one of the reasons this podcast exists. And I've talked to John many times off the air where I tell him, dude, sometimes I get so jealous that you still get to go out and hook and book and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I just miss it. Right. I do, but I'm doing what I can now, now that I'm, you know, post-retirement to still contribute to the community, still contribute to helping people. And this is the same thing you're doing. You find another way. Just find a better way and then get your own, it the battles with your own ego at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I don't, you know, and I don't have to prove anything to anybody at this point in my life. You know, I'm content with the job that I have. I get to work from home. So and I've worked from home for years. So the quarantine and pandemic hasn't affected my world per se. You know, and I'm more of an introvert than an extrovert. So it took me months to, you know, come onto your podcast.
Sure. I know. Yeah. You did contact us a long time ago and we were like, I'm like, that's a good idea. I think it's something we should discuss.
Yeah. So, you know, being at home works for me, you know, it's quiet and it's that, you know, for me, it's that safe place, but yeah, it's every now and then, you know, you come across, you know, a car accident that happens, you know, in front of you. And my knee jerk reaction is to jump out. And I always carry gloves with me and a first aid kit. You know, I'm like, you know, that part of your brain never really goes away. And, you know, for years, even after I got clean and sober, you know, my oldest, we'd be at, you know, Little League and some kid would get hurt and, you know, and he didn't understand the difference. He'd be like, my mom's a doctor. And, you know, and everybody would, you know, run and, oh, get Lynn's off the, you know, onto the field or whatever. And, you know, and kids, you know, kids, moms in the neighborhood called me at 3 a.m. You know, that happened just a few weeks ago.
Still going on.
Yeah. Aaron's got like the same problem. Hell, I did it to you when I got the Rona.
That's not a problem. That's family.
Right.
Yeah. Got people that's I don't community, even know.
For sure.
So-and-so said I could come ask you a question.
Yeah.
It's 9:45 at night.
Yeah. Like, or 3 a.m. Yeah. Or,
what's your name? Right. Yeah.
Let's start with, hi, I'm Aaron. How are you? Nice to meet you.
And by the way, the guy who referred you, I haven't talked to him in 6 months. Right. It's all good.
It's interesting you brought up earlier about that opiates was your drug of choice, because I can tell you right now, I've had to take opiates for back and knee problems that I got on the job, injuries, you know, that all contributed towards where I'm at now. And I didn't start drinking. We've talked about this on Locker Room. I didn't start drinking until I was almost, you know, all my friends were drinking at 14 or 15. I started when I was like 20. So I was a late bloomer. Yeah. But once I found alcohol, I was like, I don't feel like I feel other times. I could dig this. This is cool. And then the same thing when I got prescribed opiates for injuries, I'm like, wait a minute. Is this what normal people feel like all the time?
Yeah. Well, and so here's the thing, you know, being in recovery doesn't mean that I can't take opiates anymore. So I still have, you know, a back injury, you know, and, you know, I figure skated when I was a kid, you know, I did that for 9 years. So I've got arthritis in one hip and, you know, bad knees, and I still have, you know, my spinal injury, but there are, you know, there's some things that I choose not to take in recovery because I don't, I just don't want to fuck around with it. I don't right. want to trigger something in my brain that's going to go, oh, let's quiet the noise again. There are safe things for me to take in recovery that help me manage the pain. I had to seek and find a physician that would work with me, and he's an addiction specialist, you know? And so periodically over the years, you know, we've used what we call medication assistant treatment, you know, which, you know, I won't get into the details, but there's been various times in my recovery where, you know, the pain is increased. How do we manage that without opiates, or how do we manage that without something that's going to, you know, spiral me back down the toilet and, you know, burn my life to the ground.
Right.
So there are other options. They aren't near as amazing as the opiates are. Let me tell you, you know, there's, you know, I have to do my part. I have to, you know, I have to get up and move every day. I have to walk. I can't lay on the couch and do nothing because for me, that increases my pain. You know, I have to do certain things to help manage the pain in a way that keeps me functional and keeps me wife and mom and worker among workers. So, you know, there are ways to manage chronic pain without, you know, the chronic opiates. There's been times, you know, I had to have a foot surgery a couple of years into my sobriety. I did need narcotics. You know, they gave me Dilaudid for 4 days. I had somebody else hold the bottle for me and administer the medication because I was new in recovery and just didn't trust myself with that bottle of pills.
Right. Did you share that with him?
What's that?
Did you share that with them?
Yeah. My partner at the time knew that I was in recovery and was totally fine and was a normie. So there was no issue with that. And I ended up not taking the whole prescription and flushed the last three pills. Part of my brain was like, that's a lot of rent money. I could sell that and make rent money. You know, like there's some part of my brain, you know, there's some parts.
Oh yeah.
You know,
well, there are parts of our brains that do shit all the time that linger. Most people wouldn't understand.
Oh my God. I point out to people that one time I was at a family gathering and I was literally thinking, okay, if shit goes sideways, who's the biggest threat in my family? You know, like, there's no way my family's going to go sideways. If you met them, they're crazy, but they're not that crazy. But you can't help but have these weird thoughts. And we feel guilty. It's part of that noise you're talking about because these random like thoughts. Yeah. And you go, oh, I'm such a piece of shit for thinking that, or I'm terrible, you know, for that thought popping into my head.
There's stuff I want to talk to Tom about because no one will get the humor or no one will get the thought process.
Yeah.
No one, yeah. You know, I mean, people I work with or, you know, but like,
yeah. Well, yeah. And I, you know, thinking about it now, you know, this, when I first started using it was 20 years ago, you know, I was 21 years old when I first started that first pill came up and, you know, that was the very first time, the very first pill that I used. And I think about now what it would look like if I went back. You know, the stuff that's being cut with the heroin, the fentanyl now, I don't think I would survive. I think if I went out and tried to score today and used, I would be dead within minutes. You know, that's that's the part that scares me for my kids.
Yeah.
You know,
the amount of ODs going into the ER are
staggering.
When you have to carry Narcan, you know, as a standard tool as part of your first aid kit. That's a shitty thing. That means that we've got a problem and maybe we should look at the, you know, the source of it, which is again, that noise.
Well, even when our doctors are writing prescriptions for, you know, Norco or Percocet, whatever it is, and they're only writing a prescription for 7 to 10 pills.
Yeah.
And there's a prescription in there for Narcan.
Yeah. Right.
And because it has to be.
Right. Everybody gets a prescription for Narcan in California. I don't know if it's countrywide.
Not that way here in Oregon.
Everybody who gets a Narcan prescription.
Everyone. Yep. Yep. Everyone getting a prescription for opiates is getting a Narcan prescription,
which is really sad. Although I will say watching Narcan work is kind of funny.
Oh God, it's the worst. Listen, I've seen Narcan used, and if you want to piss an addict off, give him Narcan.
That's why it's
coming
money.
Out in withdrawals like that, and it is miserable. I never got to that place. There were times where I used enough that I hoped I would die. You know, that's how miserable I was.
Have you ever had Narcan used on you?
No. But because it's probably because I knew the math between brain and BMI, I knew that if I stopped here, I would be okay. My heart wouldn't slow down and stop. It would just slow down. So a part of me never really wanted to die. There was still that part
of my brain. Surprised your liver didn't stop.
Yeah. Well, thank God they regenerate.
Right. So, exactly.
You know, it's, yeah.
And no, thank God you didn't cross that point of no return, huh?
Yeah,
exactly. Because Narcan wasn't around, 10, 15 years ago like it is now. Nobody would have known that. And
you called an ambulance and you hoped they had Narcan on the bus. I remember watching a guy who had OD'd.
Buses weren't carrying Narcan all the time for a
while. That's what I mean, that you had to hope they had Narcan. We called the bus. We hooked a guy up and he had used right before we hooked him up and he went crazy and we took him into the jail and he started to go down inside the jail, inside our facility. He starts to go down. And we called the bus and they didn't have any Narcan. They called another bus and that, ambulance had Narcan. They came over.
I mean, you guys are like TOT to fire, and fire's like, what do you want us to do?
Right. Help them. Fucking sternum rub. I can give him a sternum rub or make him spaghetti.
Hey.
Wakey, wakey, exit bakey.
But I tell you what, when he got that Narcan, the first thing out of his mouth was, hey.
Oh,
you fucking ruined my high.
Yeah.
He was mad.
Yeah.
I mean, he was dying. Yeah. He didn't realize he was dying.
Yeah. Most guys who give Narcan to in the ER, they're not typically upset. They're just like, what happened? Some of them are like, oh man, did I almost die again?
Right.
Again.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, that's a waste.
I've got a radical idea. Let's just open up the opium dens again.
There you go.
And say, here's the deal. You really want to do it, you have to do it in there. But guess what? If there's nobody around to help you, you're screwed. And the opium den is under no legal obligation to call an ambulance if some shitty shit happens to you. I mean, that's kind of what they did at like the turn of the century, like the Edwardian era. They had opium dens.
Yes.
But I mean, we're not as heartless as we were back then. But at
they
the same
are doing
time,
something similar to that, I believe, in Canada. And I think it's part of their needle exchange program where they're offering safe places for people to use. And they have Narcan on site. They have, medical staff on site.
Well, when they open up the needle exchange program.
Yeah, right.
Exchange.
Yeah. Right. It's not. And that's the thing. You're facilitating people to destroy themselves, not to get better.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're right, exactly. Lance. It's, I don't know what the final end resolution is. It's never going to be completely gone. You can't fix it.
No, it's never going to go away. And that, like I said, that noise between my ears still exists. I wake up every morning going, okay, am I going to burn my life to the ground today by, seeking out drugs, or am I going to do the hard work, not do drugs, and do the other stuff that I do on a daily basis to keep me sober? And it would be a lot easier to get high every day. It would be so much easier, but I wouldn't be here at this point, not with the types of drugs that are available now and the way I used. I mean, if I went back, 11 years clean and sober, if I was to put 60 Percocet in my body right now, I would without a doubt die. Right. My heart would be like, no. But what was interesting is the couple of times that I've had surgery and recovery, my tolerance was still pretty high. I didn't feel those first couple of pain pills,
And how many years had it been?
The first time was I had 2.5 years clean and sober. So two and a half years.
That is a long time.
Yeah. So, it's like there's certain parts of your brain that just remember, and days get hard. My dad, died unexpectedly when I was 30 days clean and sober. I was still in rehab when my dad died, but the rehab gave me a day pass to go and be with him. which was crazy because I was coming out of neurovascular recovery, you know, 2 years earlier, and he had a stroke and bled out, you know, and the
so that was doctor, bringing up those old traumas to you.
Yeah. You know, and he had gone into surgery before the day before I checked into rehab. So technically my dad knew that I was getting clean and sober. And my dad was a police officer and knew for years that I was using and drinking. But I don't know that he ever would have turned me over. I don't think he ever would have turned me in unless I robbed him. But
yeah, everybody's got their line in their head.
Yeah, that's that line. That's that bridge I wasn't willing to cross. So, you know,
well, I'll point out that you're still going to meetings, right? You said you're still going to meetings, and this is 11 years into it. Aaron has already said that there's stuff that he and I will only discuss with each other because nobody else understands it. And I think that what that should highlight as we're bringing this to a close here is talking, right?
Yep.
You go to talk because you're talking to people that understand where you're at.
Absolutely.
Aaron and I talk to each other because, you know, John and I talk to each other because we can, because we know that if I say something to Aaron, he's going to laugh. He's going to give me some words of encouragement. And then when we walk away, he's not going to think, God, that guy's fucked up. You know, I mean, he thought that.
I mean, I've known him since high school. I mean, so I've always thought that. So it's really kind of behind us now.
Right, exactly.
I love you.
But my point is, I have a lot of friends that are what, you know, what I call normies. I've got a lot of friends that, you know, aren't addicts and alcoholics, you know, but they know that I'm in recovery. You know, and at this point in my world, you know, I'm comfortable going to dinner with them. And if they have a glass of wine, I'm okay with it. You know, but for the most part, when I first got clean and sober, my whole world was recovery. I only hung out with people that were clean and sober because I couldn't.
Well, you know, I think that's the biggest thing. That's the biggest thing is, like I was saying earlier, there was this study where people in rehab hanging out with people in rehab,
right,
was where the biggest relapse was.
Right.
So,
well, and I'll say there are some shitty rehabs, and there are 100%. Places that are bringing people in just to get their money.
Yep.
And then, you know, spitting them back out to bring them back in.
They don't care. They want to get that paycheck.
There's a documentary. Yeah. There's a documentary out that, you know, talks about, you know, how to get good drugs and get into rehab. Like, it's just this cycle. So,
but nursing homes are the same way. There's a lot of nursing homes. They don't care about your grandma. They just care about your grandma's check.
Yeah. Exactly. But there are some really great resources and there are some really great treatment facilities. You know, the one that I went to is top notch. You know, they helped me get what I needed. They stuck with me for 4 years afterwards for outpatient. You know, they had to literally ask me to leave. They were like, listen, you've got so much sober, clean time that you're not, you know, like, go, you're good.
Were you afraid to go?
I was, yeah. It was that safety net. I went once a week to their what they call a, you know, it was just a recovery support meeting, you know, just a group of people. But because I had 4 years clean and sober and these folks were just coming out 30, 60 days, you know, I had way different problems at 4 years clean and sober than they did at 30, 60 days clean and sober. So we weren't relating very well, but it was a safety net for me. Absolutely. And same thing with doing the 12 step meetings. I was doing 3 or 4 of those a day initially, because when I got out of treatment, I didn't have a job.
Right.
You know, I wasn't employed, you know, I couldn't work anywhere and I'd given up my license and it was like, well, what do I do now? You know? And so it took me a while to find that
you gotta occupy your time.
That sweet spot. Yeah. And so I didn't know where else to go. So I just went to meetings all day. And, you know, that's how I met my husband. You know, we met 11 years ago at a 12 step meeting and, you know, we stayed friends for a decade and then we got married this last August. So
congratulations.
Thank you.
And, I'm glad everything's working out. And I think that what that tells you is that the communication, the surrounding yourself with people that you can talk to, with someone that can understand you, you know, whether it's a new husband that can understand what you're going through, or in some cases, talking to your wife of 20 years and trying to explain to her, you know, what you've been dealing with as a cop or as a firefighter. You know, we think we're protecting them. And in a lot of ways we are, but there comes a point at which if you don't get it out, if you don't say it, if you don't give actual words to what's going on inside your head, you're never going to get, it's just going to fester and eat at you. And then you'll never know that beautiful moment. And Aaron, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And Linz, I'm going to guess that you know exactly what I'm talking about. That beautiful moment where you take a chance and you trust somebody by saying this really fucked up thought that's in your head, right? This really thing that's, it's been like popcorn in your teeth, you know, just this fucked up thought that's running around in your head. And you finally give, you say it to somebody and that person says, oh my God, I thought I was the only one.
Yeah.
And that moment of sharing your fucked up pain or fucked up ideology or fucked up theories or fucked up mind from this job with somebody who goes, dude, I think the same thing. The relief of knowing that you're not an alien, that you're not a psychopath,
you're not
alone. You're not a broken toy. That relief alone is worth taking the chance to actually like talk to somebody.
Hey, Linz, I got one quick question. I know we got to wrap this up, but when you were at your worst, for a normie, what's the best way to approach someone like that?
Yeah, good
like
question.
If I know how do I go? Hey,
do you need help?
Yeah,
I mean,
realistically your response at that time?
Honestly, my response at that time, my pride and ego probably would have said no. I'm fine or I'm okay. But knowing that there was somebody, you know, because even my family, you know, my mom at that point, my dad, you know, they all knew I was high. They all knew I was using drugs. They just didn't know which one.
And no one came to you.
And no one came to me. But like you said, Tom, they were chitter chattering behind my back and I was, you know, Christmas topic, you know, at dinner. So, you know, and wouldn't let me near, you know, my niece and my nephew for a long time, you know? So I remember thinking about a year after I got clean and sober, that exact question. And if somebody, anybody, whether it was a family member or somebody close to me, or maybe even my boss just said, I see something's wrong. How can I help?
Right.
You know, I don't know if I would have accepted the help, but to just be that direct and that honest, I see something's wrong. Like, you are not you. I don't need to know what's going on, but how can I help? And, you know, for folks that are still, you know, still have their license, still, you know, have their badge, there's discreet ways to get help that will save you from that, you know, that reputation, like you're saying, that shadow that follows you. There's a lot of ways that you can get help now that nobody has to know. And you can keep that anonymous, for yourself, but still get the help that's needed. You know, we're losing people via OD suicide, especially with the pandemic. We're isolating humans that can't be, shouldn't be isolated.
You know? The pandemic has definitely seen an uptick in the psych.
Mental health has been a huge
mental health has been a huge increase.
Well, I hope for those people struggling, this episode helps, especially because I know so many people that have reached out to us and said, you know, I was dealing with that same thing, or I was, you know, if there's even one or two people that are struggling right now, or if they know somebody who's struggling, just like you said, be there for them, be open to them, be willing to talk to them and let them know, hey, I'm not forcing you to do anything, but I am telling you that I'm here when you decide to do something, and I don't have to know what's going on to tell you that I'm here for you regardless.
I would love to get information on those resources you had though.
Can send them to me and we can post them, or do you, if you remember them, you can just spit them out now.
I'll send them to you after we're done.
Great. That sounds good.
You know, for the frequent flyers that are always constantly trying to, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, Linz, thank you. I appreciate it. Aaron, always, it's good to see you.
As always.
Even if we could be in person, but our busy schedules prevent us from doing that.
Good to see your beautiful face.
That's right. Linz, it's very nice to meet you. I hope you come on. We're going to be doing another episode. There's another podcast called Crash Carts and Cocktails. You can check them out. It's two trauma nurses that have some very eclectic discussions about working in nursing, and they're local to us. So we're going to try and partner up with them, and I'll probably have Aaron back for that one too, because that's going to be nurses take over. And let me tell you, as a cop, I loved nurses because nurses could do shit I could never do. Like giving somebody an instant catheter.
Yes.
Because they're being an asshole.
Or a little vitamin H, little vitamin Haldol.
There's a lot of, yeah, there's there's a lot of remedies for cognitive departure.
That's right. Oh, God. Well, I think on that note, until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.